Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, July 23rd, 2011. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. I have a very special guest today for the program, an old friend of mine and a friend of the program, Sky Shields, who's a leader of the LaRouche Basement Group. And we have a very special topic, putting an end to the fraud of the so-called second law of thermodynamics, the theory of universal entropy. On this program today, Sky will present, and knowing Sky, it will probably be presented in from five or six different directions, but he's going to present the evidence that only a fool or someone who's been brainwashed can accept this so-called second law. But I want to start by discussing an effect of belief in this fraud, and that is the accelerating collapse of our current monetary and financial system. The economic theory which is causing the present economic collapse has the same built-in systemic flaw as the ideology which asserts the law of entropy, that the universe is winding down toward heat death, that we're running out of resources, and therefore there are simply too many people on the planet. This is the outlook which has been imposed on politics, economics, and science by the forces behind the British financial empire. If this is not defeated, these British imperial fascists who are enforcing it will kill between 5 and 6 billion people on the planet, as they themselves have bragged that they're intending to do. In fact, that is what's behind the outbreaks of terror and terror warnings of the last few days, including the horrible event that took place yesterday in Oslo, in Norway. They're creating a pretext for a global dictatorship, with British puppet Barack Obama playing the role of Adolf Hitler. So our discussion today is of the highest importance. This is not an academic topic. In fact, this is a topic which, as Lyndon LaRouche said today, is central to the passionate core of his life's work, which is not just to defeat the British Empire, but to establish a truly human civilization. And I'm certain that you will know by the end of today's LaRouche Show why we have to smash any remnant of sympathy for the so-called second law of thermodynamics. So, Sky, welcome to the program.
All right. Thanks, Harley.
Now, I think we just came from a meeting with Mr. LaRouche where he put this question of the terror threat at the top. That was his opening statement, because essentially, as we've seen, the financial system is gone. We see it with the bailout process in Europe, which can't be sustained, the collapse of the so-called debt ceiling discussions in the United States. So give us a sense from what Mr. LaRouche had to say today of the absolute essential nature of the topic we're taking up.
Right. I think to give some context, because what you said is the case, that right now there's a real desperation coming from the interests that would want to try and hold this system together. But the point we've been making for a long time, and Mr. LaRouche has been making for a long time, is that the system is not sustainable. And so you want to get, there's an image, and I think it's sort of a useful image to have in mind. I mean, you can picture this surface with all kinds of different wrinkles and hills and valleys in it. And you've got little trickles of water, colored water, on that surface, and they're all running inevitably towards the direction they're going to run to. It looks like they're making decisions at every moment.
Mm-hmm.
They're hitting these little curves, they're turning. But eventually, these are all moving to puddle in the places that they intend to puddle. That is the behavior you're getting from the enemy right now. This is not some kind of, people would want to take the opportunistic stance that this is some great master plan by conspirators. And there is a conspiracy happening, but this is not something that's conscious. There's no choice. The system is gone. You're either going to reorganize the system right now, you're going to scrap everything that's been done in the last several decades, scrap the whole system of free trade, globalization, the whole system of monetarism, of defining value on the basis of monetary value. You're going to destroy that and move in the direction of a real scientific conception that LaRouche is calling for, that we're calling for. Or, if you're going to try and resist that, your only option right now is to push for a police state. That's the only option. They have no choice. This is not a brilliant master plan on their part. It's probably going to fail, and they're going to end up destroying civilization instead. But in the course, they're going to launch terrorist attacks. They're going to do everything they possibly can to try and terrify the population into submission. They're going to try and break the will of the people to try and impose, to hold this dying system together longer, but it's because they've got no choice.
Well, and as we see from the effects of this so-called summit just the other day in Europe,
right.
What do they put forward as a solution? A bigger bailout.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the problem they have is they can't pay the existing level of debt. The austerity that they're imposing is cutting back their future production, which means the future real value will be less than they have now, but they have to repay higher levels of debt with more interest.
Right.
So as Lyndon LaRouche pointed out, that this is that even from their own terms, you realize this won't work. And so that's why their plan B is not an economic policy.
Yes.
Unless you consider police state, slave labor, killing off the population, plan B.
It's clear all roads lead to the exact same place. And you could sit back and we could kind of, but it's interesting. Like you said, there's no way to leave the system alone. But so they want to bail it out. There's no way to bail it out. The act of bailing out this system will blow it up. Anything they decide to do. So I like the idea. You have this image where it's as though you've got processes happening, but it's the surface itself that's governing what the processes do. And it's important because that's exactly the image that epitomizes what the second law of thermodynamics is supposed to describe. It describes a universe that works that way, that you've got things that look like there's decisions being made. It looks like there's at each step of the way things are happening, but everything is inevitably running to the stable state that it's moving towards.
And there's a fraud embedded in the surface.
Exactly.
Yeah, because what people think is that this is the nature of the universe, that the decisions that people are making, which go against the natural creativity of the physical universe, but those decisions that they're making are inevitably leading to this choice of either a globalized economy with no sovereign nation states, no democracy. I mean, Barroso of the European Committee came out and said, we can't afford democracy right now. Mm-hmm. And so they're arguing that this is something fixed about the universe.
Right. No, it's true. And in as far as it goes, it's in a sense, it's true. There is no action you could take right now that would change things as long as you're operating within that surface. As long as you're operating within that geometry, there is no such thing as free will. There are no independent players in this political situation right now. Nobody's got an intention here. Not Obama. Not the people who are controlling Obama. They've got impulses, and they'll passionately act in the interest of those impulses, and they'll be convinced it's them.
But that's a form of the brainwashing.
Oh yes.
Because to the extent, now I don't know about Obama. I don't want to assume that he has any conscious thoughts on these things. But some of these people have to have thought this through and realized that there's going to be an explosion of some sort. And when you say there is a conspiracy, the only aspect of the conspiracy that's real is that they're trying to figure out how they'll end up on top.
Yeah, right. But
and the consequences, the collateral damage, the 6 billion people die, what of it?
Oh, right. But for them, it's an animal instinct, though. They've got no conscious control. The real human act in this situation would be to act to change that entire geometry. And that's when you get, it's one of the things that's, I mean, the most basic fallacy, among other things, of the second law is that the so-called second law of thermodynamics is that, you know, it's a law that was written to apply to a very specific kind of closed system and to explain how non-cognitive processes would unfold with respect to that closed system.
Now, let me ask you something on this, because Clausius and the people who were responsible for this initially, did they start with the assumption that the universe as a whole is a closed system?
I'll tell you, if you read Clausius, Boltzmann, the real criminals in this, they start with a different agenda entirely. They're driven by an ideology about how the universe works. There's already a hatred of human creativity. It's important. What they come up with is not a derivation from what Carnot works out. If you read Clausius' own writings when he's being candid and philosophical, or you read Boltzmann's own writings, or read his letters and his debates with Zermelo on it, they're explicit. They're complete pessimists. They hate the human species. They really dislike. You see, Boltzmann in his debate with Zermelo is enraged that Zermelo is optimistic. And he expresses this complete rage in this paper. Meanwhile, Zermelo is making jokes towards Boltzmann. Boltzmann writes back these completely pessimistic letters that, for the record, mirror his poetry. If you read his poetry, he's got the most depressing and pessimistic view. There's one where he describes in detail his own death, which he eventually reifies with his own actions and his own suicide later on. But he describes his own death, and he describes himself ascending to heaven and meeting Beethoven there. And when he meets Beethoven in heaven, Beethoven is completely morose because, you know, he tries to ask him, well, why are you so depressed? Do you still write music? And Beethoven says, no, I don't write music any longer. I promised God I'd write the trumpets for the last judgment, but besides that, I won't do anything. And because everything is just so nice here, and really I need the misery of the created world in order to even write something that's beautiful. And he just described, he keeps going. I won't go into more detail.
No, but that there's a profound pessimism that's expressed by
profound.
That. But so, Skye, they did not have a sense that they were dealing with a universal principle, or did they actually ascribe to their own ravings a universal principle?
I think their ideology, the only thing that was universal in for the two of them was, for Boltzmann, it's explicit. He's trying to finish the Newtonian-Laplace program. And there's all these areas that do not fall under mechanics. They just don't. Laplace tried to grab all sorts of things and encompass them under Newtonian mechanics. But then at this time, if you look at where Planck and these other figures are working, there's whole fields that just don't. You've got all these breakthroughs happening, electrodynamics and thermodynamics. This is solely in the abiotic. This is not even discussing the living and the cognitive.
Because at the same time that these guys were writing, you had the work of Dirichlet and Riemann.
Yes.
Where you're actually encompassing the creative noetic as a part of the same universe. There's not a separation for them.
And under those circumstances, there's no need, and as Planck himself says, you cannot carry any discussion of that second law into any other domain, certainly not into the universal. But again, Clausius, Boltzmann, these guys have a different agenda, and the people who promote them have a different agenda. And to give you a flavor of it, I mean, take a look at what I think most people now know in their hearts when you're looking at any of these environmentalist freaks who you find on the television, or you find their agenda expressed through cartoons and all kinds of other films, etc. You realize that the real issue at the core of their philosophical outlook is a hatred of the human species. They hate human development. They hate the idea that man would represent something distinct from a beast. And they despise it. And they'll say that explicitly. I mean, you get the great extremes from these PETA people for the ethical treatment of animals, where for them, and you've seen their ad campaigns, they relish the idea of presenting images of eviscerated human beings.
But this is explicit in people like Bertrand Russell. Explicit in Prince Philip and Prince Bernhard, the founders of the World Wildlife Fund.
It's explicit in Al Gore. I mean, you can see from his massage parlors how he treats other human beings. Sort of his view. He's got somewhat like the idea of some large furry animal. you get that what they start off with is a hatred of human beings, and then they pick and choose the science to fit that. Mm-hmm. Then they pick and choose. I mean, one of the projects we're going to have coming out of the basement in over the next few weeks, and what we've been, the direction we've been pursuing over the last month or so, or last several months, or almost a year now since last summer, last August, as Mr. LaRouche keeps pointing out, is that the biosphere is this amazing process. It's as far as you could possibly imagine from a closed system. And the most important elements in it are completely not understood. Something basic, the major player in climate, just maintaining a global temperature, the simplest thing, temperature, are clouds. Nobody has any idea what's required for cloud formation. And in particular, the different types of clouds that are formed. The more we look into it, you realize that there's likely for all clouds, there's electrodynamic processes that are required for their formation. It's not simply a question of condensation of water vapor. For specific types of clouds, like, say, thunder clouds, which build this amazing electromagnetic structure within them, you get the charge separation that permits lightning, nobody has any idea where that structure comes from. For other clouds, the ones that are most responsible for cooling on the planet, Henrik Svensmark in Denmark has done a lot of work demonstrating beyond a shadow of a doubt and that their formation depends on cosmic radiation. And in fact, over at CERN, they've just ran an experiment that, again, demonstrated this, and their results have been gagged. They're not allowed to. There was an order issued from the top at CERN that you can publish the results of this experiment, but nobody who's working on it, none of the real scientists who are working on this, are allowed to draw any conclusions from this experiment because it would be too politicized. So they're deciding they're going to try and suffocate this thing from the top, you know, because it disagrees with what's being stated in the IPCC. It disagrees with what's being come from
Al Gore. From their statistical models that assume entropy is the basis of the universe.
Right, yes. You finally have an experiment that demonstrates how something in climate works, as opposed to these idiotic computer models, which are tweaked to give a specific end, and it's being gagged. So you realize that there's no science coming from the other side. There's no intention to promote the advancement of scientific knowledge. It's a political agenda to begin with, and the agenda is the destruction of the human species and the maintenance of empire.
Well, now this came up explicitly in the panel that you did with Professor Poulenets at the recently concluded Schiller Institute conference in Rüsselsheim. I had the great pleasure of being there with you and attending and watching an audience being awed, in a sense, by this idea of the power of human creativity through science as an economic human factor, which was then reinforced by the beautiful music, the Musikabend that was there. Now, Professor Poulenets actually went through this suffocation of science,
right,
where he said, well, we probably could do a lot more, but it's being stopped. I wonder if you'd just comment on that, because that was a common factor that kept coming up, that the evidence of the creative universe is what they're trying to wipe out by their choices of what's funded and what's not funded.
I mean, I'll say, look, if you honestly, and we've been making a point to do it on the website, if you honestly present to somebody a picture of how the universe around them works, I mean, first, if you honestly present it, you'll end up with more questions than answers. But the questions put together in one system as one picture, it's the most amazing, most beautiful thing you've ever seen. I mean, you take a look again, like at the Poulenets has put together, you know, he takes the question of he demonstrates that this thing we call earthquakes are not primarily, the most important aspects of them will not be studied by seismologists.
Right. The rubbing of plates.
Exactly, yes. And whether or not the plates even exist, all this is in question. How much of that is happening? But you're not going to be looking into the ground to study them. You're going to look at the processes that extend beyond Earth's atmosphere that they're connected to. And he demonstrates that you can see in the phenomena you call earthquakes, you see changes in the Earth's ionosphere, and changes that are so clear and so sharp that you can use them to get a reading for earthquakes before they even happen. But what it really gives you a sense of is you realize that, wow, this system that I live in, it's not some little ball floating in empty space that must be defended, our little marble that you get from
or
these.
If you just watch a weather forecast, just as an example, because we just started now on the LaRouche Pack website, Peter Martinson did our first weather forecast.
Yes.
If you watch a weather forecast, they usually get a good-looking woman or a somewhat seriously-looking guy who sits there and shows how clouds are moving, and it's as though your weather can be predicted because of what happened in California or Newfoundland or coming up through the Caribbean, and that all there is to forecasting is being able to watch which way the clouds are going, the jet stream, and hot air bunching up against cold air. And it's really, that's the way most people think of it, as a simple causal relationships of so-called fronts.
Mm-hmm. And it's because they've got the wrong view of the role of the human species. It's at one point, if you take a look at the history of human knowledge, there's not a single science that became a serious science without becoming an experimental science first. As long as something remained a descriptive science where we're sort of observing and making up stories about it, you can't progress. I mean, take biology. If you can't do real experiments in biology, you're limited in what you can possibly say by just trying to describe it. You're making up stories. As soon as we decide to act on it, and this is an important thing about the character of the human species, once we act on something, we can get knowledge about it. Without action, you get no knowledge. And we can take this into the discussion of doing political intelligence afterwards, because that's an important lesson that You can't be the armchair political analyst.
Yeah.
That won't work. You've got to be acting in the system, seeing how it responds to your action, then you know something. But what that means then for so-called climatology is that it's going to remain a completely superstitious science, not even a science, it's going to be become a superstition governed by political intrigue as it is right now, as you see with the IPCC, as you see with this whole the idiocy around this Kyoto Treaty. Everything done is like looks like a pagan religion. It will remain that way until we organize ourselves to act on the climate experimentally. Until we organize ourselves as a species to act on this thing with a conscious intent to change it. Now, this is something we've been promoting as the first steps around our project NWAPA.
Mm-hmm.
You know, actively intervening as a species to transform what we know as the climate.
You're listening to Sky Shields. This is the LaRouche Show. It's the 23rd of July, 2011. We just had an extraordinary webcast from Lyndon LaRouche, which is now available on our website, including Lyndon LaRouche giving an object lesson of how to deal with the stupid questions that you probably get when you go out and start to organize. So, and Mr. LaRouche said the most important word to use in dealing with stupid questions is the word bullshit.
Right.
So that's available on our website. Also, Sky has a couple of very provocative videos on the nature of time as viewed through the extremely important subject of music. And the subject of music is the human mind. It's not notes or sheet music. And I think you'll find that interesting. Now, Sky, let's just get back to the second law for a moment so we can dispense with this and get on to the actual nature of our creative universe. The assertion of the second law of thermodynamics is something which is actually disproven by almost each of the three phase spaces that Vernadsky looks at, as well as the interrelationships between the three. So how is it that people can still adhere to it as though it's a law?
Well, I'll tell you, there's not on Vernadsky, I think he's got his statement addressing the question, I think he's got these beautiful ways to get straight to the point. And on this one, he writes a paper called "It's the Problem of Time in Contemporary Science," unpublished. It's a speech he gives in December of 1931, and in the speech, he's discussing all these things that he's making a point to eliminate this notion of time as some kind of absolute given in the way Newton described it. He says, "Well, look, time has to become something that's a subject of our experimental investigations to see whether this exists or is it a shadow of other processes that actually do exist," and meaning that this thing we call time, the thing we call space, is an accident of sense perception. And he eventually concludes
the way we've studied it or viewed it up to this point in time.
Yeah, or even calling it a thing, the idea that you can lay out events, and the idea that you can describe the relationship between events using the terms before, after,
any
faster,
sequential order,
slower, right.
Yeah.
That's an accident of sense perception. Things are projected that way, but are they actually that way in reality? And you saw the first stabs to really eliminate that notion around some of the work of what Einstein did with relativity,
mm-hmm.
where you realize that even to describe some basic phenomena in electrodynamics, to bring those into agreement with mechanics, you had to scrap the notion of simultaneity, that there exists any such thing as a moment. Vernadsky takes it further, and he's got one nice section where he does a history of the valid parts of what you might call the second law. He does a little history of the work of Carnot, other people who are doing work on heat engines,
mm-hmm.
why this is interesting, and it makes you start to think of some notion called time.
Because within certain closed systems, there's no question that you have a certain kind of entropy.
Yeah, there's something there. Then what do you mean? The trouble is the word entropy is used for about 100 different things.
Yeah.
You know, from the stupid example that you get in your physics textbook, which tends to be like your bedroom. You know, doesn't your bedroom tend to get messier? But it means 100. What they're talking about, he says what Sadi Carnot talks about is one thing, significant.
Mm-hmm.
But then he says Clausius attempts to extend this to the universe. He says in that form, it's a theory that has no relation to reality, and he dismisses. But then he says, but you've got other processes that seem to manifest this arrow of time. He calls it a polarity of time. you get the things that there are thermodynamic processes that seem to manifest that. But then he says two things. One is he says radioactive decay also seems to manifest this arrow, and then living process manifests the arrow. Now, he says that both living processes and radioactive decay move in the opposite direction than what you see in thermodynamics. Mm-hmm. Now, it's sort of, for I think the English-speaking audience, it's a little, seems extra counterintuitive to say radioactive decay is actually moving in an anti-entropic direction. Uh-huh. But it's because in Russian, the word for decay is not decay. Our decay has got certain connotations attached to it. But Vernadsky says, no, this is change. This is a transformation in time. And in fact, from the standpoint of being the biogeochemist he is, he sees that this radioactive transformation, in fact, plays a net anti-entropic role in the development of the biosphere. And he takes that as being the major source, as it's being discovered now to be true, he takes that to be the major source of, for example, heat within the Earth, as opposed to, he's completely opposed to the really silly dynamo theory, the idea that the Earth has a molten core. Mm-hmm. He says it's a theory, and he lists all the problems with it, which anybody who does any serious work on the dynamo theory would realize. The idea that you've got some kind of a molten magnet in the center of the Earth where there exists no molten magnets anywhere else in the universe. It's absurd. And in fact, as you start to look now at like Jupiter's moon Ganymede, you take a look at Mercury and you see planets which by any existing are completely incapable because of their size and age of having any sort of a molten metal core, but also have magnetic fields which mm-hmm. reflect what you see on Earth. So Vernadsky's able to realize, well, you do have this other arrow of time here that's connected to anti-entropy, but then what he says is that it's wrong to treat these two arrows as positive and negative of the same thing. That anti-entropy is not the opposite of entropy. Mm-hmm. That this is not true. And, you know, the example we've used before is, I like to say, anti-entropy is not the opposite of entropy any more than a chair is the opposite of its shadow. One has an actual existence to it and has a character, has a certain physics to it. The other one is a thing that you see in comparison with the object that really exists.
But I think this gets a little bit at the whole question of how the empire functions. Because the empire, through the Royal Academy of Science, through the peer review and things of that sort, actually coins the definitions mm-hmm. which shape the way people see things, right. Like the concept of space. The concept right. of space itself is that which exists between things.
Yeah, right.
And so naturally, with sense perception, it seems empty. Mm-hmm. If you have entropy as a word that's accepted because of the work of Boltzmann, Clausius, and others, the idea of anti is the opposite,
right.
As opposed to, as you say, one has a real existence and the other doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is, in a sense, I think this is one of the simpler level that Mr. LaRouche is emphasizing, that the definitions that are used in all of these things, such as monetary value,
right,
that these are the right. controlling factors that make people susceptible to the brainwashing that allows the oligarchy to continue its domination of the
right.
planet.
You start with a blatant lie. I mean, in that case, it's the funniest thing ever. That idea that money has any intrinsic value. I mean, again, we've often used them, but it's useful. The simplest, even, I don't know if it's worth even calling them thought experiments. You know, you on a desert island, what good is your money going to do you? You know,
I like the other one Lynn has, which is you take $2, stick them in a dark room, and you open it up, they fornicate, and they're now $6 or $7.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, you know, that's the theory behind the stock market right now. Is
compound interest,
yes.
The greatest discovery in the world.
Yes, right, exactly.
Yeah, it's the higher level theft.
We have one of our friends, one of Mr. LaRouche's friends, Pobis Kuznetsov, who did a lot of, major work, research work on biological processes in space. What does it take to keep a human being alive in space? Which again is where, if you want real breakthroughs in biology, it's going to come from that, not looking at biology per se here, not by curing disease here on Earth, but by tackling problems head on in space, are we going to advance medicine?
Which in fact already has happened with the NASA program,
oh, yes.
which is being shut down now. The Houston Medical Center, for example, is a product of the collaboration on the highest levels of the space medical programs.
Yeah, our real breakthrough. And then including one of the breakthroughs that Dr. Kuznetsov makes, says he lists as his, one of his most important breakthroughs, is he discovered that of all the things that you needed in space to keep a human being alive, money was not among them. There was no need at all on any shuttle, on any space station, for a stack of dollar bills. And, you know, it's a joke, but really it's a question of understanding the physics of a process. You know, money plays a role in making the physical process happen. It does, permitting it to occur.
Well, money is credit.
Exactly, yeah. As credit.
Yeah, but exactly. The idea that there's value in the money.
Absolutely not.
And this does get at this question that we took up at the very beginning of the program, which is that the idea that somehow you can have a process of debt creation solve a problem that is literally the problem is lack of physical production. Mm-hmm. And the more debt you create, the more you take away from physical production.
Right.
And so it's a self-fulfilling prophecy that you're going to end up with bigger debts. And what do they say is the solution?
Right.
Get rid of the government. As
right.
opposed to the simplest thing, which is you want to stop a debt problem, stop the bailouts, no more quantitative easing, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and go back to a credit system.
And this gets, again, that image again of this surface with all the ripples in it. And you've got all these, the question of the trying to find the value in money is like trying to find the purpose in those run the little rivulets of water on that surface. The value is defined by the surface. That's the real physical economy. That's what are you producing? That's where do you intend the species to go? What are your major development projects? What physical wealth are you producing? If you've got physical wealth being produced, you can now, that gives money, that future value that you're investing in gives value to your credit. Nothing else gives a value. It has no intrinsic value.
And the value is the future production.
Exactly.
Not the money you're going to make from producing something.
Right.
Which is the difference between a consumer society and what we used to have, which is a producer economy.
And it gets back to this question of entropy again, because then you realize, okay, well, what has an ontological existence, what has actual demonstrable physical reality is human creative activity. Because that creative activity lends value to everything. Outside of human creative activity, there is no value in anything. And so you've got to figure out how do you organize a universe where that's primary. And as Vernadsky points out, that has major implications for this question of time as well. That if you say, instead of saying that there is some absolute thing called time in which actions take place, because there's not, you can demonstrate that that's not true. And also conversely, you can't find any proof to demonstrate that there is such a thing as absolute time. If instead, say, you have actions, and you've got the one action that defines what gives the other one's value, which is human creative activity. Creativity in general gives the other activity their value. Then you build your universe the other direction. You start at creativity, and you can work down to where something looks like time appears as a shadow. But as soon as you look at it at a different angle, it vanishes. It's like the shadow in that chair. It has no real existence in and of itself. The creativity is what has the actual existence. And this is not it's not a platitude. It's not a nice thing to say. The only thing that you can give any kind of effective existence to, the only thing you can subject to scientific investigation is human creativity and anything else in the universe that looks like that.
And isn't that the actual implicit understanding of the fervent believers in the second law is they don't believe in creativity.
Exactly.
They create a universe which has no creativity, or maybe once had a creator who waved a wand, created something, and now it's winding down.
Right. I think this is manifested in Boltzmann's silly story about Beethoven, mm-hmm. that you start to realize that they have a major flaw in the center of their soul, which is that they don't recognize, or for neurotic reasons, don't want to recognize what human creativity is, and that's what you respond to in other human beings, but also what you respond to, since it's the core of all human beings, it's also the basis for any human activity, including the real sum total of all human activity, which is economy, human economic progress.
Well, and this guy is one of the things that was very powerful in the discussion we had with Mr. LaRouche today, mm-hmm. where he said, what is the motivating force behind the creativity? It's love of mankind.
Right.
It's love of that potential in the future generations, as well as love for recognizing what past generations did to struggle despite horrendous circumstances. If you look at all of human history, it's a tragedy where brief moments people rose to challenge the oligarchy. Many of them paid for it with their lives. And his point today was that you have to have something worth fighting for and willing to die for to really be human. And you see people like Boltzmann and others who essentially are moral and intellectual cowards because they're running away from that sense of responsibility. Right. Right. As opposed to someone like a Riemann or a Vernadsky, yes, or an Einstein, who put up with all the crap they get from their so-called contemporaries, mm-hmm, because they're fighting for something higher.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, on this question, we're with Sky Shields. This is the LaRouche Show for the 23rd of July, 2011. We're taking up some of the, in more general terms, some of what's in videos now available on the LaRouchePack.com website. We're waiting for, actually, why don't we just pick up the work that Cody's doing right now to give people a sense of, because we are talking, again, this is not academic. Mm-hmm. It's not just that the financial system's collapsing. It's that the collapse of the financial system will prevent us from having the kind of creative intervention which is going to be necessary to save humanity as we enter into what you might call a kill zone in the galaxy.
Yeah, right.
So Cody Jones, who did a beautiful video previously, is updating and upgrading it. Why don't you give us a sense of that?
I mean, the idea now is to really, again, to not tackle some of the stuff head on, because at a certain point the argument on the second law, environmentalism, etc., becomes, it's like arguing with your crazy relative. Somebody's trying to explain to you that they're being chased by pink bunnies in a helicopter, and you're going to sit down with them and explain to them why. Look, well, the reason that's wrong is because rabbits can't fly helicopters, and you're going to give them this elaborate proof. And your proof may be true, but I can guarantee you that you're not going to make any headway with the
person you're
talking
to. They still see the
bunnies
up in the sky.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The core of their problem is something else.
Yes.
It is not the impossibility of the physics of the bunny flying the helicopter. Same thing is true with all this anthropogenic global warming and all the other stuff. The problem is not that they don't have the facts. They have the facts. They're lying. Half of them are lying. Half of them are insane. And, you know, maybe there's some overlap between the two, depending on who you're talking about.
The crazy liars.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. So the real issue is, well, how does the universe work? We have to get on with the business of driving human society where it should go. And the same, in line with what we've been doing on the economic questions, you have to figure out, well, forget about all the scandal-mongering about the enemy. Like we said, there is no conspiracy that they're in conscious control of. They're panicking, and they're using conspiratorial methods in order to panic, but they're panicking. There's no way they can get what they want. The only thing they could possibly do is kill us in the process.
Mm-hmm.
They could drag us down with them. That's the threat, not that they're going to succeed in what they're trying to do. So our responsibility then is to do what we need to do and get them the hell out of the way. So where do we need to go? As though we were to rewind these last few failed decades of human history. We're going to undo everything that's been done over the course of these last few decades.
Which has been provably a failure.
Oh, yes.
One of the things that I've suggested we take up in organizing is you ask someone, why is it that outside of Lyndon LaRouche, there's no one with a solution to a financial crash that hit in the summer of 2007?
Right.
And it was forecastable by LaRouche a decade earlier. Why is it that no one has an answer to that?
Yeah. Well, and the issue is that you have to now back up and say, okay, well, if I were running the nation, and this prospect makes people more nervous than they think, and amongst our organizers, it's a nervous thing to do, to say, well, now we're the leadership. What do you do? And this is the essence of LaRouche's identity, of Lynn's identity. If you look at everything he writes, he always writes from the standpoint of being, you know, president, but frankly, something that's a lot larger than the president is his identity. He's a historical figure. He's a statesman. And he's thinking from the standpoint of the individual who's leading humanity. So he says, well, what are the next steps in our evolution that are needed? And so from that standpoint, you can pick key programs like NWAPA. You recognize the necessity to get off of the planet, but you understand it more clearly if you back all the way up and do what Cody's going to do. and what he started in this last video, what he'll be taking up in more detail in this video, is say, we're going to recognize the fact that the universe as a whole is anti-entropic. Mm-hmm. All we've ever observed of the universe is anti-entropy. Again, it's not as though it's not true that this is some thermodynamic miracle and everything else is entropic. We've observed nothing else in the universe but this thermodynamic miracle, so-called. That's what it is. The universe is, you know, I'll agree with the term, but not the sense that it's used. The universe is miraculous in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
But that's all it does.
Right.
It only moves in the direction of anti-entropy. The entire history of life on this planet has been that. It's been the steady, creative increase in motion of life and living processes in the atmosphere to higher and higher levels.
The idea of a constant upward evolution.
Constantly.
Which is not a linear evolution.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because then that's where it becomes interesting. Then you start looking, well, what are the internal characteristics of this development? How does it happen? We know it does happen. But now how does it happen? And then you start to look at key transformations. You take a look at things, the so-called mass extinction events, which is, I'm more and more convinced, just an incorrect term. If you look at what happens around the so-called KT extinction, the KT boundary, the boundary between the Cretaceous and the Tertiary, which, you know, people recognize as being when the dinosaurs vanished.
Right.
But what actually happens, it's not some disastrous thing. You know, they're still looking for the meteorite that would have caused that, because they're not going to find it.
Right.
They're not going to find the meteorite. They're not going to find the volcano. They try to glue them together to get something that happens. What happens is not a mass death, but it's a complete transformation in the way the planet is organized. You get an upshift from these, frankly, quite relatively, you know, the useless animals. The dinosaurs are relatively useless,
right,
compared to a mammal. But then the whole system transforms to maintain these mammals. You get the development of grasses. You get the development of these new flowering plants that are capable of bearing fruits.
Which are more efficient or productive, you might say, in their use of the cosmic radiation.
Exactly. They're more energy dense. They convert that sunlight now into, you know, as we know, the more nutritious part of the plant, the development of fruits.
And nature itself has a concept of energy flux density.
Exactly. Well, that it's
chloroform and so chlorophyll.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. It's taking, if you were to take the, now, look at evolution not as the evolution of individual organisms, but of processes, you see that the energy, the net energy throughput, and then the, as Lynn says, not in quantity, but in terms of quantity per unit area, the energy flux density of the process, and I think we'd add per unit volume if you want to talk about something like what becomes stored now in the sugar of a fruit versus in the body of a fern or something like that, and the availability of that to other processes, the whole thing shifts upward in a net way every time you have one of these major. Again, they're called extinction events, but really they're platform upshifts, where you wipe certain things out in order it's as though that entire period prior was only there for the development of the period that came later.
In a sense, Guy, when you're speaking now, I remember back when we founded the Fusion Energy Foundation, and what Lynn talked about is the natural shift that it should occur from nuclear fission technologies to fusion.
Yes.
That in order to get to fusion, you have to increase the rate of attrition of the uranium resources to go on almost a blowout of what you can do with fission.
Right.
To upgrade the society as a whole to now then incorporate the higher technology of fusion.
Exactly. You're exhausting the existing platform only to make it to the next platform. So I like the word that Mr. LaRouche has been using instead of infrastructure. He's been
platform.
Stressing the idea of platform, because it gives you the idea that you're really moving from level to level. It's not there to...
And it's not just a simple thing, but the platform encompasses the whole development of the biosphere,
exactly,
the abiotic, and the human.
The whole system changes. It's not one element of it. It's not as though you're just... People's discussion of energy production is so stupid. The whole question of trying to compare, well, what gives you more energy, windmills or a nuclear power plant? First, yes, a nuclear power plant, hands down, wins that one, but it wins on a more fundamental level, because what the nuclear breakthrough represents is an entirely new way of operating in the universe for the human species. The motion from nuclear fission to nuclear fusion is going to be the necessary step, not to get more electricity. We'll get more electricity because we'll need it. but it's a necessary step to get us off the hell off this planet. The only way to move our species off this planet is going to be with the development of all the technology that comes with fusion power, which is going to be the types of fusion-powered rockets that we'll need to move off the planet. It'll be the ability to reduce materials down to their fundamental elemental constituents using what's been called the fusion torch.
So you can take even lesser-grade ores and still produce
high-quality
alloys and minerals.
Right. Yeah, right. And if you look back at the biosphere, it does this. So Cody making this argument is going to be very powerful, because you're going to realize that nowhere in the biosphere do you see this stupid environmentalist delicate balance. It's just not true. There is no delicate system there that stays in equilibrium. It's the opposite of that.
Well, it actually reaffirms what Aeschylus wrote about as the Promethean, that in fact the universe is tending toward higher degree of Promethean intervention.
Right, right. And we would be absurd to do anything less. The only things that don't do that, there's many things that don't do that. In fact, 99% of all species that have ever existed have been of the sort that they don't make that breakthrough because they're not human. 99% of all species who have ever existed are gone. The vast majority of every type of species, of every type of organism that's lived on this planet no longer exists, because it is relatively fixed compared to the process that it's inside of. The process moves on without it. And the process...
So as Lynn says, the natural, the biotic and the abiotic actually have a creative impulse of their own.
Exactly. And it grinds up.
It's in their DNA, so
exactly.
To speak.
But not in the individual things.
Right.
The individual elements are ground up as it goes. They go extinct. They're only to be used up to reach the next level. Now, with us as a species, you've got the first thing on the planet, the first thing in the universe that doesn't vanish to move to that next level. The only thing we have to destroy are our bad ideas. We dump systems the way the biosphere dumps animals. And we should. We move constantly to new and new energy resources. We never stop and try to find something sustainable, because nothing's sustainable. There is no such thing as anything sustainable except for that process of progress. You keep moving. You keep developing. You keep changing. You keep increasing our population.
Well, and that's the refutation of the second law right there.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Yes. It makes the second law irrelevant. It's not even something you can put the two in the same room. Again, this is beyond the distinction.
You can't even say, at one point, this might have been true.
No, not even.
It's never true.
They're not even on the same par. Again, yeah. Back to the chair and shadow thing. You can't compare, but it's more difficult. The whole idea of the second law is a stupid ideology. This other thing, this creativity, the way the universe develops, that's reality.
Now, Sky, this brings us, we only have about 13 minutes, and I wish we had another couple of hours, because this has been, I hope it's been enlightening to our listeners, because they can now go to the website and take what you've said and make a lot more sense out of what they're seeing from a lot of the so-called science videos we're posting. Mm-hmm. But I want to get to two things quickly, because one, you just talked about this question of immortality, that the human being has this power that no other species has, immortality. But secondly, I'd like to take up first this question, creativity per se, the case of Johann Sebastian Bach, which is dear to my heart, and I know is becoming increasingly part of what you're working on and thinking about. So what is it you've discovered from looking at the Bach fugue that is coexistent with the same process we're discussing of the higher order of creative organization of the universe and man's mind?
Well, I'll take a funny angle to it. I mean, this is where you get, in order to do the work that he does, Vernadsky launches a big attack on the fraud that we've all been, that's been perpetrated against all of us, which is that we are beings who watch the universe. And, you know, it's been promoted that the idea that, well, science is that, is you, outside of some other thing called the universe, are observing the universe and seeing what it does. But then if you try to take that and push it, you can go a little ways with that as an assumption, but then there's things you're ignoring in order to do that. At a certain point, though, it hits a breakpoint. And a lot of this breakpoint we saw in the early 20th century around the so-called quantum, where it became really clear that the human being exists in the universe. Should have been clear prior. But at that point, it became even more clear that it's not possible to have some objective description of the universe, because everything you do, the universe tells you that, no, you're here also. You're sort of like in a sense, we're a thing chasing our own tail.
Well, it also should force us to recognize that the idea of sense perception is a foolish way
of
operating in the universe.
That is not that somehow that you got to take seriously this thing as mind as distinct from sense perception, but as a fundamental part of that so-called objective universe.
Right.
You've got to scrap the distinction between objective and subjective. Now, not in the creepy baby boomer quantum 1960s kind of, oh, my mind is this force now and everything I will happen. That's bullshit. Only some things your mind does actually works. And we've got a whole history of human civilization to demonstrate that. Some modes of organizing human civilization work. Other ones do not. Some modes of human behavior function, other ones do not. This is the real meaning of morality. It's not some question of some rules that you find in a book somewhere and, you know, who follows them best is gonna get their rewards in the afterlife. That's bullshit. Morality is what kinds of ideas function effectively in the universe around you. That's the only metric. That's the only metric. But now, that means that you have a science of mind to investigate, that you have to investigate to understand how the universe works, because you have to say, well, how does this universe incorporate mind? On this, the most brilliant thinker you've got and tool you've got is the work of Bach. Now, it's a funny thing. Is it? There's something to be investigated there in the music, per se, because of what it does.
Mm-hmm.
But the subject of the investigation really is what, you know, Plato's has Socrates say in one of these dialogues, which is that he says, we enjoy music because it moves with the same harmonies as those with which our souls are composed. Now that, again, you could say that and everybody will be happy and they'll put that on a poster on their wall with a sunset in the background on it. You know, think it's a good... But that's a rigorous scientific statement. That's not just a nice thing to say. There really is. The way you see the ontology of mind is you feel how mind responds to classical composition, not any music. I mean, you can learn something from how mind responds to a rock song, but you learn the same thing from all the rock songs. You just get mind decaying, and you find yourself becoming stupider.
Become more like a rock.
More like a rock, precisely, yeah. Yeah, less distinction there. So, but now if you say, well, instead, I'm going to see the ontology of what my mind does as it responds to a composition by Bach, as everybody else has stressed, specifically to Bach's fugues. I mean, all of his works and all the work you'll get from Bach up through Mozart and Beethoven and Schubert and Brahms, you'll get this effect that something is being there's an ability to move the mind and to draw out capabilities that otherwise would not be conscious. That you can move things that you otherwise capabilities in people they wouldn't expect to be in themselves. Bach is capable of taking a whole peasant population and uplifting them to the real divine level that the divine potential that they've got inside of them.
Well, and it starts, the fugue is a specific form, but counterpoint in general, the mm-hmm. idea that you can start hearing something beyond one voice, and that you begin to realize that there's something between the two voices that changes. And what's the change? I mean, there are two voices singing, but the change is heard in your mind.
Yes, and the part you hear...
And Bach writes it for that specific purpose, mm-hmm. to create the change in the mind, to give someone an insight into what he was thinking when he introduced the second voice.
And you get, that's the real way you get somebody out of their senses. It's not by negating. You know, we can attack sense perception and make these statements. The best thing you do is you use the senses. Through the senses, you move the mind in such a way that, you know, in a funny way, the listener says to you, well, you know, in a healthy way, I've never been touched there before. I didn't know I had that part of me.
And we saw that sky at Rüsselsheim.
Yes.
Because the concert there was a brilliant example of a successive development of ideas. Mm-hmm. And one of the singular moments was when Antonella Benaudi sang the aria from Verdi's Masked Ball.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And it was with such passion and such an idea content that people were moved to tears who didn't know what the words were.
You saw her outside of herself. She was moved by something entirely else. And, you know, and then the entire audience, you know, being the audience, you were there, I was there. You're outside of yourself in response. You go with her where she went. And it has a useful effect. I mean, it's useful to have the pedagogy to demonstrate to you, in a sense, sensibly, that you are distinct from your body.
Well, yes, Guy, you probably saw this. I had that experience playing the violin in the Choral Fantasy because I had to get outside of myself, because in myself I couldn't play it. But actually, the piece as a whole moved me to do things that I couldn't do when I was practicing it by myself.
Okay, right.
And so you see how that works for someone in the orchestra, that and then you think about the effect that has on an audience. But the point Lynn has been making, and you've made it beautifully in these two videos. And by the way, let me just say, go to our website. We have the Musikabend, the concert from Rüsselsheim, is posted on the website, along with a number of the speeches. And I'd recommend the keynote from Helga Zeppler-Rusch, the two presentations by Lyndon, and then your panel with Poulenets, and then the final panel where Lynn spoke, but also Benaudi spoke. Mm-hmm. So you can see these, you can work through it, and see what we're talking about. Be affected by it from the inside. Now, this is what you're looking at in music. What is the connection of the emotional content of the moving of the mind to what you might call a musical universe?
Right. And, you know, it's not a coincidence then that this shows up, because then now you say, okay, in what way do you bring mind into this so-called objective universe? As you're looking, you realize all these things you're running into, these dead ends around the question of the quantum, the stuff that Vernadsky's investigating, that it's not a simple question of... It is a question of when you want to bring mind into that, what you have to bring into it is this question of classical composition. You say, well, the laws that I find here, maybe they're universal. And you realize, for instance, irony as a principle, the taking of a closed system and driving it until its own internal contradictions, and that only through those internal contradictions can you make the next step.
Because a Bach fugue is full
of
ironies.
Exactly that, yes.
Full of ironies. He violates every law up to that time of the so-called fugal principle.
And it's always the way it moves as though through these things. You take a development, and he'll let the development run until it looks like it's wrapped itself up, until, you know, how do you move? And he'll intentionally create paradoxes there, that from the standpoint of a formal musical system are paradoxical, but then be able to move out of it. And in fact, use it to reach a step that he was never at before.
Well, and that's done so systematically by him in the Well-Tempered Clavier, the two volumes of the 24 major and minor keys, the Preludes and Fugues. And then that experience is summarized in a sense in the Art of the Fugue and the counterpoint in there. Those pieces and the musical offering were the basis of the musical revolution made by Mozart and then Beethoven.
Right.
And so you get a sense that this question of creativity is something that exists in the sovereign human mind, but it has to be expressed outward to generate a creative response in a mind of someone else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, it has to be. And you realize, also, it's the only form of interaction you can have with anybody else. The same thing, again, back to that surface you've got with the little driplets of water running across it. Most of the interaction we have with other people is the way that water runs across the surface. Is your neuroses are relating to their neuroses, and that's it. And you may comment on them, but the real interaction between people is that has substance to it is changing the nature of that surface.
It's above the surface.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's the thing that transforms how you interact. You're constantly consciously changing your interaction with the other person to improve yourself and hopefully to improve them.
This is what we were talking about before the program from Schiller's Letters on the Aesthetical Education, where you have the physical, the moral, but that they're both existences. They're both drives.
Yes.
But unless you get above it,
right,
the play drive, as the Spieltrieb, as Schiller describes it. But what's the playful? It's that principle of creativity, that experiment in the imagination, which is actually the basis of discovery in science.
Right. And I think it gives you a real theological sense that's different. That people, I think there's a real correlation in my mind between Schiller's relationship between the Formtrieb and the Stofftrieb, using the Spieltrieb, his form drive and your material drive unified by this play that unifies the two of them. And in my mind, it's a pure version of that quote you get in the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." I really do think you're drawing this unification there between these two worlds that other people would want to make separate. And you're saying, no, I will make truth and principle express itself in the physical universe.
And so in that sense, we act in the image of the Creator.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, this is this is very exciting. I mean, this is just, I hope we've given you a sense of the kind of work. And I would add just one final point to pull the whole program together. It's this approach to physical science which is the basis of real economics. Not how much money did you make, how far can you get leverage on a piece of paper that's worthless. That's not economics. That's thievery. People should go to jail for that. But this is the essence of economics.
And, I agree. Amen to that.
And this is what Lyndon LaRouche demonstrated in the webcast. Go to our website, watch the webcast, watch these new videos from LPAC TV. Sky, it's been a real pleasure having you here today.
It's been a lot of fun, Harley. Thanks for having me.
And we'll be back next week with another edition of The LaRouche Show.